This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
As fighting continues in the Middle East, there are rising concerns about the humanitarian needs in Gaza.
Increasingly, I think people are getting worried about, will there be enough food? Will there be enough electricity?
Also today, if you like wildlife and solitude, the time to visit the Galapagos Islands was yesterday.
It's like seeing a private concert of your favorite artist, but instead of like a singer, it's animals.
But now, Ecuador is luring visitors back with a plan to vaccinate people at the tourist destination. I'm Carol Hills. And want to know the reason why Parisians love cafe culture so much?
Most Parisians live in relatively modest spaces, and so life really happens outside of the home.
Tomorrow, Paris cafes are back. That's ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Fighting continues in Israel and Gaza for a ninth straight day. President Biden has said he'd welcome a ceasefire, but both Israel and the militant group Hamas show few signs of letting up. Hamas continues to hit Israel with rockets, and Israel strikes back at targets in Gaza. We begin our Middle East coverage with the latest developments. The World's Ariel Osseran is in Tel Aviv. Ariel, what's the latest on the ground where you are?
It briefly felt today like maybe the beginning of the end. I mean, cross-border fighting between Israel and Hamas did continue, but relatively to previous days, it did not seem as intense, at least on the Israeli side. There were fewer rockets fired at towns on the southern part of Israel, still 600 rockets in 2 days, but that is fewer, and Tel Aviv hasn't been targeted in the past couple of days. On the Palestinian side, Israeli Air Force continued with dozens of air raids in the Gaza Strip. It says it's targeting Hamas militant targets. And while all this is happening, hundreds of thousands of Palestinians in the West Bank, East Jerusalem, as well as Arab citizens in Israel, went on strike today. This was a rare collective action against Israel's policies and the operation in Gaza. But then things flared up again, as Israeli airstrikes toppled a six-story building in Gaza, and this joins the massive destruction and rubble now filling the streets of Gaza. Across the border, a rocket strike launched from the Gaza Strip killed two Thai nationals in a packing plant in southern Israel. So as it stands, neither side seems to be working towards a ceasefire anytime soon.
So what could bring on a ceasefire at this point?
Well, it depends on the pace of attacks and the sense of victory on both sides. Then it depends on the international community. You have world leaders, including President Biden, who spoke with both leaders of Israel and the Palestinian Authority. And in his phone call with Prime Minister Netanyahu last night, Biden fell short of applying actual pressure and only voiced support for a ceasefire. The Egyptians and Qataris are also mediating, and EU ministers are meeting today to talk about a possible ceasefire. But Shimrit Meir, a senior Middle East analyst, tells me that a ceasefire is still premature at this point. She says that as long as Hamas commanders are still breathing, they will continue to rain rocket fire on Israeli towns.
I think that if it ends right now, Hamas will most likely get out of the tunnels and of the, you know, underground bunkers that they have over the destruction of Gaza, will declare victory. And this will be just the beginning of the next conflict.
That's why, according to the Israeli military perspective, they still need more time, but that's also winding down.
And during that time, we're seeing more and more images of massive destruction in Gaza. More than 200 Palestinians have been killed so far. Almost half of them are reportedly women and children. According to the Israeli side, what needs to happen for this to stop?
despite the awful pictures coming out of Gaza, many Israelis still say that it's Hamas that started this firing of rockets at Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, and they should stop first. So far on the Israeli side, you've also had at least 12 people have died on the Israeli side. For example, earlier today, as humanitarian aid and fuel were being delivered into Gaza through the Erez crossing on the Israel-Gaza border, militant groups from inside the Gaza Strip fired mortars at the crossing, lightly injuring a soldier. This was as the aid was crossing in. As you say, in the meantime, there is massive loss of life and destruction on the Palestinian side. I asked Shimrit Meir, the Middle East analyst, about this changing anytime soon.
The basic thing would be that Hamas would say, we're done. And we are not there yet. I think if Hamas will go on, let's say, Al Jazeera, and will say, we are ready for a ceasefire, then I think there will be a ceasefire in a matter of days.
Meir says she doesn't see a readiness on Hamas's side for this, and she also adds that so far there hasn't really been any urgency among the major mediators in this conflict, especially Egypt, to end the round of fighting.
The World's Ariel Osseron in Israel will have more coverage of the ongoing conflict in the Middle East later in the program. Thanks, Ariel.
Thank you.
The Galapagos Islands lost a popular tourist attraction this week. A rock formation called Darwin's Arch collapsed into the sea. Ecuadorian officials say the cause was natural erosion. Charles Darwin did his research there in the 1830s. Today, the Galapagos economy depends mostly on tourism, but that's been hit hard by the pandemic. Now the government of Ecuador is trying to get every adult on the remote islands vaccinated by the end of this month. Manuel Rueda reports that the islanders are hoping this will lure visitors back.
As a guide on the Galapagos Islands, Javier Cando used to spend his days taking visitors through windy trails, teeming with iguanas, sea lions, and blue-footed boobies. But tourism on the islands collapsed when the pandemic broke out, and Cando now spends his mornings milking cows at the farm where he grew up in Santa Cruz Island.
When I was guiding before the pandemic, I used to make like $150 to $200 a day minimum. Here, selling 50 to 60 liters of milk and make $50, $60 a day. So it's very hard, but I've been doing this since I was little one with my parents.
Cando is hoping that the archipelago's vaccination program will help him to work as a guide again. In April, the government of Ecuador purchased 40,000 coronavirus shots from Pfizer and had them sent to the Galapagos, which only has a population of 30,000 people. In mainland Ecuador, only 6% of the people have been vaccinated. But officials are hoping to have all adults on the islands vaccinated by the end of this month.
Los ecosistemas isleños tienen un nivel de mayor vulnerabilidad a las pandemias.
Because we're far from the mainland and their hospital capacity is limited, we're more vulnerable to new variants of the virus, says Galapagos Governor Norman Ray. He's at a basketball gym where hundreds of people are getting their first shots of the vaccine. Vaccination is also expected to lure tourists back to the islands. The message we want to send, Ray says, is that this is a safe destination to visit. For decades, the Galapagos has depended on tourism to sustain its small population. It generated 85% of the island's GDP in 2019. More than 9/10 of the island's land area is covered by a national park, which limits agriculture. The sea around the island is a marine reserve, where only small boats are allowed to fish. Many people have been unemployed since the pandemic broke out.
Por ahora está cerrado el hotel, porque no hay huéspedes.
I work at a hotel, and it's been closed for more than a year, says Betty Freire, a housekeeper who's at the gym to get her shot. There's almost no tourists at the moment, but I hope the vaccine will make things better, she says. In Puerto Ayora, the largest town on the archipelago, dozens of restaurants have had to shut down. And cruise boats that used to take tourists around the islands now spend most of their time anchored at the harbor. Travel agents say their sales have plummeted. Before the pandemic, it was high season almost all year round, says Osvaldo Álvarez, who owns a tour agency on Charles Darwin Street. Now his business only handles about a quarter of the customers it used to have each week. But that's also good news for those who are lucky enough to make it to the archipelago. Emily Ming En Wen from Los Angeles recently visited North Seymour Island on a day tour, where she took selfies with blue-footed boobies and walked along a beach packed with sea lions. Her tour boat could fit 16 people, but only had half as many passengers. Only two boats stopped at the uninhabited island that day.
I feel like right now is a special time to travel just because there aren't a lot of people around. So I think the relationship that you have with the environment and with the animals is going to be... it's unique. It's like seeing a private concert of your favorite artist, but instead of like a singer, it's animals.
At his dairy farm, Javier Cando figures it could take up to 2 years for tourism to return back to normal. He says tourists will always be important for the islands, but he hopes the pandemic also encourages locals to find new sources of income.
It's the moment to think and to improve and to see what else we are able to do, what else, what capacity we have to survive. I know that's what we usually call survival of the fittest, you know, for this species, and now we are in that process too.
For The World, I'm Manuel Rueda in the Galapagos Islands.
France is starting to open back up. Tomorrow, movie theaters and museums will welcome back customers at partial capacity. For many Parisians, though, there's only one thing on their minds, the return of La Terrasse. Rebecca Rossman has a report.
This table needs a good sanding. For days now, the staff at the Café des Anges in the 11th arrondissement of Paris have been dusting and polishing as they prepare to open for the first time in 6 months.
So today we were cleaning a lot. We already put the terrace how it should be to see for us on Wednesday. So actually, we're ready.
Catherine Mauta is the daytime manager here. She says she's missed the bustling ambiance, which typically attracts a flurry of 20 and 30-somethings sprinkled along the spacious outdoor terrace. But starting tomorrow, they'll be back. That's when cafes can open for outdoor dining at 50% capacity.
I think the people will be really happy to be outside, to be allowed to eat on the terrace or to have a drink on the terrace. It's the art of Paris, yeah.
The outdoor terrace isn't a strictly Parisian phenomenon, but it carries a special weight in a city as dense as this one. Lindsay Tremuda is a journalist and author of the books The New Paris and The New Parisienne. She says in a way, the city's terraces and cafes are like extensions of the home.
Most Parisians live in relatively modest, you know, modest spaces. And so life really happens outside of the home. That's the social foundation of life for Parisians.
That's why the last 6 months have been excruciating for so many here in Paris. It's the longest stretch of time in modern French history the cafes have been shut.
Even during wartime, the cafes were not closed.
While cafes are eager to reopen, there's also new challenges. According to one recent study, more than 110,000 people in France have quit the hospitality industry in the last year. Long hours, low pay, and the instability exacerbated by COVID-19 are all contributing factors. The young staff hosing down the dusty wicker chairs at this outdoor pizzeria, for example, tell me they've all been hired within the last couple of weeks. Another test of long-term survival will be the summer tourist season. Still, cafe owners don't expect to have any trouble attracting locals. Arthur Marzouk is a 27-year-old consultant eating a falafel sandwich in the Place des Vosges. But he says he's sick of takeaway and ready to sit down in a proper cafe.
We are all waiting for this for now. We have been waiting for this for 6 months now. And we are just expecting to can go outside again because it's starting to get a little bit hard when you stay all time at home, not being able to go to the restaurant.
Even with thunderstorms expected on Wednesday, Marzouk plans on having lunch outside with his family at their favorite steak brasserie. They'll be bringing umbrellas, he says. For The World, I'm Rebecca Rossman in Paris.
Just ahead, the Japanese baseball player who's putting on a show this season.
Shohei! The money! Showtime!
What makes Shohei Ohtani so special? Coming up right after the stretch. This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Southeast Asia is battling a COVID outbreak right now. The Philippines is one of the hardest hit nations there. Vaccines have become more available, but most Filipinos are hesitant to get the shot. This has health professionals frustrated and confused. A few years ago, the Philippines had some of the highest vaccine confidence rates in the world. Reporter Ashley Westerman reports from Manila on what happened.
For Heidi Fugero, the pandemic has been really hard. The 42-year-old's eyes start to tear up as she tells me she had to continue working as a food vendor to support her family. This was particularly risky for Fugero. She's a breast cancer survivor and has diabetes. But when I asked her if she planned to get vaccinated, she said through a translator, no.
Dahil po, unang-una po sa lahat, meron po akong breast cancer, di ba? Diabetic.
With her comorbidities, Fugero says she's afraid the vaccine will make her weak, and she's heard about side effects from friends. Fugero also worries the vaccines haven't been tested enough.
How long would it take, and how much study or science would it take to change your mind?
Siguro matagal ang panahon, hindi pa ngayon.
Maybe a long time from now, Fugero says. In fact, her whole family and much of her neighborhood wants to wait until there's more evidence that the vaccines are safe. Vaccine hesitancy is a nationwide problem here in the Philippines. A Pulse Asia survey released earlier this year revealed that 6 out of 10 Filipinos didn't want to get vaccinated. There are many reasons, including rampant misinformation and conspiracy theories online about them. Plus, there just aren't enough vaccines in the country yet. And if you do happen to get an appointment, it's an arduous and inefficient process. But all of that is compounded by a recent vaccine-related incident. Here's what happened.
The dengue fever is an endemic disease in the Philippines. So in 2016, when the dengue vaccine, or more commonly called Dengvaxia, became a viable vaccine as recommended by the WHO, it was a big deal for the country.
That's Madeline Ong, a researcher at Ateneo School of Medicine and Public Health. She says what happened traumatized the country. Dengvaxia is made by the French pharmaceutical company Sanofi, and the Philippines was the first country to roll it out on a massive scale. The program aimed to vaccinate 1 million 9-year-olds through their schools. It started in April of 2016. More than a year later, Sanofi came out with a devastating statement that basically said,
for children that never had dengue before, if you vaccinate them, they would experience a higher risk of getting hospitalized or having severe disease if they do get infected with dengue after getting vaccinated.
After that, Ong says things spun out of control. Stories of mothers who believe their children had been harmed by the vaccine spread like wildfire. Government agencies publicly blamed each other. Emotional hearings were broadcast, and an investigation was launched.
I think this controversy sort of ran in a protracted nature. It wasn't a 1 week or a month event. We were hearing about Dengvaxia for a really long time.
But even though the deaths of only 3 children were found to have been linked to Dengvaxia, Ong says public confidence was crushed. And surveys following the controversy found that the Philippines' confidence in vaccines tanked from 93% in 2015 to 32% in 2018.
I would prefer actually to use the term trauma rather than hesitancy.
Dr. Joshua San Pedro is with the Manila-based nonprofit Coalition for People's Right to Health. He says health professionals have their work cut out for them because a lot of the public just doesn't believe the government will have their backs if something goes wrong with the COVID-19 vaccines too. Meanwhile, the Philippine government's information about vaccines, while prolific, has sometimes been confusing, even contradictory. Like earlier this month when President Rodrigo Duterte got inoculated with the Sinopharm vaccine.
The president's doctor gave clearance for the president's inoculation. The application for emergency use authorization of Sinopharm has been submitted to FDA and still waiting for approval.
After the move received backlash, Duterte sent much of the Sinopharm doses back to China. That same week, the World Health Organization approved the vaccine for emergency use. Joshua San Pedro says bad messaging from the government.
It leads to a lot of fake news, a lot of misinformation.
Today, less than 1% of the country has been fully vaccinated against COVID-19. And most of the doses that have come to the Philippines are from China and are not as effective as Pfizer or Moderna. San Pedro says his group is working to educate the public by meeting them on a cultural level to calm their fears.
Instead of scaring them by telling them that if you don't get vaccinated, you won't be able to travel, you won't be able to go to work. So we are really focused on discussing it as a right.
Ultimately, getting vaccinated is a decision people have to make for themselves. San Pedro says it's likely going to take some time for the Filipino people to gain their confidence back in vaccines. Time they may not have. For The World, I'm Ashley Westerman in Manila.
This next story is not necessarily for you baseball fans out there. It's for those of you who should be following baseball, because you are missing out on a once-in-a-four-generation talent, a man who has been called a Swiss Army knife, and the Japanese Babe Ruth. I'm talking about Shohei Ohtani of the Los Angeles Angels.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. Shohei Ohtani. What can't he do?
What makes Ohtani a Swiss Army knife is that he does everything. Last month, Ohtani became the first player in a century to pitch in a game while he was leading the league in home runs hit. The last guy to do that, Babe Ruth. In Japan, he started turning heads in high school, then kept turning them. By doing things like throwing the fastest pitch ever recorded in a Japanese professional game. In his first three seasons in the U.S., Ohtani played well, but was often injured. Questions arose whether he was overdoing it. His manager, Joe Maddon, said, Ohtani can do it all, so let him do it all.
Shohei Ohtani could be one of the greatest players of his generation, given the opportunity. I don't want to tell him what he can or cannot do. So let's just see what he does and watch.
We'll be watching. A massive and deadly cyclone made landfall last night in India, ravaging the western coast of Gujarat, all while India struggles with a coronavirus surge. Read more about Cyclone Tauta in our daily newsletter. Sign up at theworld.org/newsletters. You're listening to The World. A new book offers an immigrant's guide to America. One piece of advice for newcomers: be prepared for an overwhelming amount of choice. Like in the grocery store.
Aisles and aisles of cereal and biscuits and breakfast foods.
How to navigate this strange new land, coming up on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. The top story of the day is the ongoing conflict in Israel and Gaza. We wanted to zero in on Gaza for a few minutes. It's a narrow coastal strip sandwiched between Israel and Egypt, a small enclave packed with some 2 million people. Israeli airstrikes are targeting Hamas militants there, but because Gaza is so densely populated, ordinary civilians are paying the price. Fresh water is in short supply. Sewage systems have been decimated, sending wastewater into the streets. And people are scrambling to find shelter and basic necessities. Matthias Schmala directs UNRWA, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees in Gaza. He joins us from Gaza City. Matthias, what has today been like for you and those you work with?
For me, this feels like war since a few days. And what I mean by that is there is a constant firing of rockets from here, followed by severe retaliatory strikes. People are terrified. At least once an hour or every second hour, there is military confrontation that affects concentration and what we do. That's one bit. And we as UNRWA are increasingly dealing with people who have fled their homes out of fear. We now have 48,000 people in 58 of our 278 schools, you know, looking for safety. The blue flag of the United Nations for them means a safer place than at home. So we are dealing with, you know, the fear in that way. Then, of course, there's injuries. I was informed an hour ago that one of our health workers got very badly injured on his way home from one of our health centers. He was just in the wrong place at the wrong time and is now in the ICU in hospital. So injuries are part of it.
Help us get a sense of the scale of the humanitarian disaster there. I mean, what sort of infrastructure for ordinary citizens existed 2 weeks ago that is simply no longer there?
We've had several primary health care centers leveled to the ground, including one of MSF.
And that's Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders.
Yes, exactly. We've had the central laboratory conducting the COVID-19 tests directly hit. Well, I don't know if it was directly hit, but it's out of action. Now there's no testing capacity. Another impact is the thousands of people in our schools huddling together, often in, you know, very confined spaces. So one of our big worries is that our schools will become now centers for spreading the COVID-19 virus. Now, shops are beginning to have empty shelves. So increasingly, I think people are getting worried about, will there be enough food? Will there be enough electricity? Fuel supplies are going down. The central power plant here depends on fuel. So fuel averages per day are down to 6 or 8 hours from 10 to 12 before the war and going down. I understand we'll be out of fuel in a few days. Water is a problem, and that has to do with damaged infrastructure, also desalination plants and connecting pipes and so on being destroyed.
Are humanitarian corridors open, and is aid getting into Gaza?
In contrast to the 2014 war, the borders have been completely shut, although with one small modification, we apparently did get some fuel today, 5 fuel trucks. So that was the first time in 8-9 days that the border was open for us, but then they immediately closed it again. We were supposed to bring some food trucks in as well, but we were then told it was getting too dangerous. So we are into a second week with this place completely shut off from the rest of the world. We've also not had corridors to move people in and out. And maybe as importantly, within Gaza, there's constant fighting and there's so far been no agreed periods where we can move more freely.
So where is humanitarian relief coming from?
So far, and I believe it's the same for others here, but UNRWA is the biggest player in Gaza. We are having to rely on what we had brought in before the war started. The big shortage we will have is for these 58 schools that have turned into emergency shelters. If the border doesn't open, there will be a shortage of water there. And of course, the longer it takes, we estimate that later this week, by Thursday, Friday, people will need food.
What is morale like, or the state of mind among ordinary civilians in Gaza?
Really, I think people are afraid, wondering where's the next bomb going to come from. I think frustration, you know, 2-3 weeks ago, there was actually a bit of a period of optimism here related to the Palestinian elections. You know, a very high number of people who can vote registered, over 90% of the population that can vote did register, many of them young people, first-time voters. So there was a bit a sense of, maybe this is the beginning of a new political process. Of course, that went down the drain. And now we are in the middle of a war. And many parents talk to me about their main worry is their children. First of all, how do you explain this constant loud noise? How do you explain buildings in your neighborhood collapsing, you know, people dying? And how do you explain what the future will bring? So I think it's the combination of fear, of worry about the future that is really dominating people's mood.
Matthias Schmala directs UNRWA, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees. He's been speaking to us from Gaza. Thank you, Matthias.
Thank you very much for this opportunity.
Some argue that Washington has clearly picked a side in the ongoing battle in the Middle East. The U.S. sends Israel roughly $3.3 billion annually in foreign military financing. The Biden administration also recently approved the sale of $735 million worth of weapons to Israel. The proposed sale was announced before the current hostilities and is still pending. Zaha Hassan has been examining the transfers of American weapons to Israel. She's with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and she joins us now. Zaha, $3.3 billion a year. That's a big number. Put that in context. How much military financing does the U.S. provide to other countries in the region?
So with respect to foreign military financing, Israel is receiving about 52% of all foreign military financing, and that's more than all other countries combined that are receiving that assistance. And another thing that's very exceptional about the security assistance that Israel gets is that it also gets a percentage that it can use for purchases within its own country. No other foreign government is allowed to purchase from outside the U.S., but Israel is allowed to do that so that it can develop its own capabilities. Today, Israel has become a leading exporter of weapons, making around $9 billion a year.
Now, I want to talk about the so-called Leahy Amendments. Those are laws meant to stop the U.S. from giving military help to countries that violate human rights. How is that law applied to weapon sales to Israel?
So actually, the Leahy laws call for a couple of things. First, it calls for vetting of military units receiving U.S. security assistance, and it calls for cutting off assistance to police and military units that are receiving U.S. security assistance if they're using it to violate human rights. With Israel, the problem with applying the Leahy laws is that it's very difficult to trace security assistance that the U.S. has given Israel. Israel gets grants, and a portion of it is cash, and cash is fungible. Therefore, it's difficult to track and trace. So if a person who's aggrieved by a human rights abuse from Israel tries to complain about a violation of the Leahy law, it's incredibly difficult to prove.
Well, why is it set up that way in the first place?
That's a great question. And that's the reason why Betty McCollum, Representative Betty McCollum, and 19 other members of Congress are calling for requiring the State Department to do better reporting on the use of security assistance by particular Israeli military units and police.
Israel is a tiny country. It has a population of around 9 million. It's a democracy and a key regional ally. It's surrounded by historical enemies that have long wanted to destroy the nation. The Arab world has more than 400 million people. Why shouldn't the U.S. help its ally?
I'm not saying that the U.S. shouldn't provide assistance to its allies, but I will say that the U.S. should be better at monitoring the use of U.S. security assistance so that it isn't used for gross violations of human rights.
Israeli military power also helps keep Iran in check. Isn't it the U.S.'s interest that Israel be well-armed?
And it is. It is well-armed. As I said, they are a leading exporter now of weapons, and that's not the question. It's not whether or not the U.S. should be providing security assistance to Israel. It's whether or not Israel is entitled to use it any way it wants, including to further its de facto annexation of Palestinian territory.
Zaha Hassan is with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. She was talking about the transfers of American weapons to Israel. Zaha, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And just a note, we reached out to the U.S. State Department for comment, and a spokesperson wrote, and this is a quote, "We are restricted under federal law and regulation from publicly commenting on or confirming details of licensing activity related to direct commercial sales of export-controlled defense articles or services. We remain deeply concerned about the current violence and are working towards achieving a sustainable calm." In Taiwan, there's a gun control debate playing out. That's not that unusual in itself, but Taiwan is a country with hardly any guns. The government there has extremely strict laws on firearms. Almost no one is allowed to own them, except for one type of citizen. And as the World's Patrick Nguyen reports, this group is increasingly frustrated with the government telling them how to live.
It's late at night, and a man is creeping through the mountains of Taiwan, pursuing his target. Two eyes appear in the dark. The man raises his rifle, and he shoots, and a small deer falls to the ground. This is from a news documentary channel called TT Show in Taiwan, where a guy just hunting a deer, something 10 million Americans do every year, is edgy television. They even blurred the hunter's face. He wasn't doing anything illegal, but using a gun is taboo in Taiwan, unless you're from certain communities in the mountains.
Not many Taiwanese go into the deep forest where the indigenous people will go.
Professor Curtis Pei, a well-known wildlife conservationist in Taiwan. He's also a bridge between the majority Han Chinese and indigenous peoples, who comprise only 2% of the population. And Pei is the first to say it. most people in Taiwan don't understand how important hunting is to indigenous communities.
The majority of the Taiwanese, they don't know what is hunting, and they're afraid of firearms.
So afraid that the government will only allow indigenous people to use extremely archaic guns, muzzle-loading rifles, the same kind used in the U.S. Revolutionary War. Hunters mostly use these guns to shoot deer, called muntjac, which are about as big as a Great Dane. Professor Pei says they also hunt other animals.
Wild boar, mountain goat, and monkey, the macaques.
I ask him, are any of these creatures rare?
Oh, no, they are not endangered, and none of the species I mentioned endangered.
Taiwan's indigenous people have seen outsiders, both traders and invaders, come and go for centuries. The Portuguese, the Japanese, and finally, Han Chinese, who fled to the island to escape communism in the 1950s. It was that final group, the Chinese, who formed a government and said to the native people, look, if you insist on hunting, you can only use old-fashioned muzzle loaders, ones that you make in your own backyard.
And we all know that the homemade firearm actually is not safe.
They're not safe at all. They often jam or misfire in people's hands. That is a report on one of Taiwan's indigenous news channels about a tragic misfire of a gun, which injured a hunter. This is a common occurrence up in the mountains, so they would prefer to use modern weapons, rifles that in America you can buy at Walmart, but they can't. From their perspective, it's just another way that an occupying people tell them how to live. Indigenous groups have been protesting. That does make the news in Taiwan, but it's not working. A court ruling this month said the law is not going to change. Judges worry about guns falling into the hands of criminals and also overhunting. But Professor Pei, who is a wildlife conservationist, says no one is more committed to preserving the balance of nature than indigenous hunters. The public in Taiwan, he says, needs to listen to the island's minorities.
More dialogue with general public to let more people understand what is really going on in the mountains.
Indigenous hunters are the rightful guardians of Taiwan's habitat, and he says the government should let them hunt as they please. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
The Republic of Somaliland celebrates its Independence Day today. Don't confuse Somaliland with Somalia. They're right next to each other on the map, but Somaliland declared its independence 30 years ago. Even so, as the world's Africa correspondent Halima Gikandi reports, few countries actually recognize it as a nation.
The streets of Somaliland's capital, Hargeisa, are crowded. Videos online show people waving the green, red, and white national flag and blaring patriotic music from cars stuck in traffic. They're celebrating 30 years of independence. Jama Muse Jama is the director of the Hargeisa Cultural Center. He says young people are especially riled up today.
These young people have no clue idea what was the identity before Somaliland. They were born in Somaliland. They know only Somaliland, and they consider Somaliland being their identity.
At 54 years old, however, Jama remembers the time before Somaliland's independence. He was born in the Somali Republic, a union of former Italian and British colonies that joined together after independence in 1960. But that union didn't work out, and in 1991, Somaliland decided to declare itself an independent state. Jama says he's proud of what Somaliland has accomplished in the past 30 years.
Wow, at the age of 30, the power of that age is what Somalilanders are feeling. But also, it's kind of disappointment with the entire world.
Disappointed with a world that has yet to officially recognize Somaliland, he means. The African Union doesn't recognize it, and neither does the United States. But in many ways, Somaliland does function as a de facto independent state. Ishmael Shirwa is a Somaliland diplomat based in Nairobi, Kenya.
We've had many political and diplomatic engagements with many countries around the world. We've been practicing our values even without having international recognition.
In recent years, Somaliland has expanded its diplomatic and business relations with countries like Taiwan, the UAE, and Kenya. Many view Somaliland as a more stable partner than neighboring Somalia, which continues to struggle with political strife and terrorism.
We have proven that we are an island of hope in an ocean of unrest and autocracy.
Unlike many countries in the region, Somaliland has had multiple successful one-person, one-vote elections and peaceful transfers of power. In the past 3 decades, there have been multiple attempts at dialogue between Somaliland and Somalia. But Shirwa says there's one thing that's completely off the table.
Every Somalilander tells you that the people of the Republic of Somaliland have no intention of reuniting with Somalia.
He says he's confident that the rest of the world will eventually recognize his country. But today is a time for celebration. For the world, I'm Halima Gikandi in Nairobi.
Imagine having a handy guide to the United States as a new immigrant, one that tells you how to navigate this strange new place, and one that also includes the sights and smells that you'd most miss from back home. Iranian-American writer Roya Hakakian scripted this out. Her latest book is called A Beginner's Guide to America for the Immigrant and the Curious. My colleague Marco Werman spoke with her. Hakakian was at her home in Connecticut. Here's Marco.
So I got to say, some of the small details you've observed about the immigrant experience, I actually connect with myself. I notice, for example, the bounty in this country when I returned from working in West Africa for 3 years, like just the variety and options of breakfast cereal in the supermarket aisle. So I'm wondering, what are some of the things that still stop you in your tracks since you arrived in the U.S. some 35 years ago?
Precisely what you just pointed out, that, you know, we sometimes in America become unaware of the variety that exists, not just in our media, in our options of readings, books, publications, but also, you know, foods in supermarkets and aisles of cereal and you know, biscuits and breakfast foods. And you know, it's easy to be turned off by all of it and say, you know, Americans just have too much. But what I try to do and have done, you know, in the past couple of decades, thinking through what America means to me, is to kind of extract what all that really means beyond variety. And what I've come to is that it's all about choice. America gives us choice. America enables us to look at what's available and make our own decisions.
So that's the positive side. It's about choice.
I think so, you know, because alternatively, if we didn't live in a democratic country, and, you know, that was my life once, we would not have the choice. The choice would be imposed on us. You know, the varieties would diminish greatly in the numbers. And we would have it in some ways, in a bizarre way, easier, because we would not have the burden of considering, balancing, and making a conscious decision of our own for which we will have to bear responsibility.
So recall for us what it was like in 1985 when you emigrated, you were much younger, from Iran, and to now be in this place that was both perplexing and at the same time a place that provided safety and something new.
I think that first encounter with America is such a ubiquitous experience that no matter how long passes or has passed between my own arrival and others who have arrived more recently seem to share that experience in common. I remember being completely disoriented, as if my jet lag wasn't just a matter of time difference, but was also a matter of continental difference, emotional difference, intellectual difference. And I think I was walking around perfectly disoriented and dizzy for weeks and weeks, which is what others who have arrived far more recently than I affirm and say that their experience has been the same.
What about the flip side? Were there a couple of things in America where you said, that makes total sense? I mean, do you recall the first time maybe you had that experience?
Completely. I recall being in the first year of college, which came a few months after I had arrived. A boy asked me out. And we were on the beach walking, and for a moment he put his hand on my shoulder,
And at first I panicked because I thought, oh, we're going to get arrested because we're not married. We're walking together and we're not related. But then, you know, I looked at him and I looked at the beach and I realized that I'm not where I used to be. I'm in America. And that was liberating. It was a wonderful new discovery about being out and about without anxiety.
I'm speaking with poet and writer Roya Hakakian, who writes about the immigrant experience in the U.S. When you left Iran in 1985, the country is going through a lot of change. Do you ever compare the lives of your family members today in the U.S. versus friends you left behind in Iran?
I do. And it's a painful reminder of what an accident our births and our circumstances lead our lives to become. That, in other words, I simply, by being able to leave Iran under completely accidental circumstances, because, you know, had we applied for our exit visas a couple of months earlier or a couple of months later, we may never have received them. You know, the idea of this book came to me in 2016 when Donald Trump gave some of his early speeches about his plans for immigration. And one of the ideas in one of the speeches was, we cannot accept, or we should not accept, immigrants who don't speak English or have no skills into this country. And I gasped hearing this because I thought, oh my God, had I been the Roya, the person that I was this year, trying to get into America, I would not have gotten in. So because I had neither English nor any skills, so I would have stayed, I would have been kept out of the country that now I believe to be my home. So what I'm trying to say is that the injustice of it all, whether, you know, barred by circumstances inside Iran or barred potentially by the decision of an American president, my life could have been entirely something different from what it is today.
I want to mention also, Roya, you're an activist, and I know you've taken an interest in the rise of vocal feminism in your native Iran, and specifically Iran's kind of Me Too moment. So as we speak about what immigrants to the U.S. Experience, I'm wondering what women especially might be seeing and learning from the movements in Iran and the U.S. right now.
I hope what they're learning is that, first and foremost, that feminism is not a local phenomenon, that it is a destiny for all women everywhere around the globe, that we are all, as women and as world citizens, are in this fight together. And there's a sisterhood that binds us all together. And if we do not support us, if we do not support each other and don't win our battles, our struggles against gender inequality, all of us at the end suffer.
Writer and poet Roya Hakakian is the author of the book, A Beginner's Guide to America for the Immigrant and the Curious. Roya, great meeting you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
And here's where we say goodbye for the day, but we're always online at theworld.org. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. I'm Carol Hills, back with you again tomorrow.